You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, policy analyst at the Center for American Progress, Matt Duss, will be with us to discuss the latest on the march to war against Syria. Also on the program, perhaps some cracks in Russia that could lead to a negotiated settlement. We shall see. We'll get to that story as about the NYPD treating mosques as terrorist centers. Still yet to get to that story about Fukushima. I think we have probably, sadly, 40 to 60 years to talk about this. Also, the Department of Justice allowing marijuana decriminalization and actually becoming legal in two states in this country, and sad report which shows that apparently nearly all of you, short of Michael in this office, don't get paid vacations very often. In fact, One Piece suggests that you get less paid vacation time, or I should say less vacation time, than peasants from the 15th century. Also, an update on our favorite Chief Kessler from Pennsylvania. And John McCain shows what a serious, well, I guess what a poker face is really all about, I guess is really the only way to put that. We're going to get to Matt Duss in just a second. I want to say that this is a fairly big event here at Majority Report HQ. We have our largest live audience that we've had since the launch of the program. We are welcoming today to the studio Ryan. He is a 15-year-old high school student who's getting into some production work at his high school. That sounds like a pretty decent high school. And wanted to view the program. And fortunately, his father, John, showed up too, because yesterday I had the it occurred to me, as I told Matt and Mike, that we're going to have a high school student here coming here tomorrow. I said, should I have maybe checked with his parents to see if he was allowed to do this? But fortunately, it's not a runaway situation as far as I can tell, unless father-son have decided to run away, which I can appreciate that sentiment as well. All right, folks, just a reminder, the app is going to be released in about a week. We will give you more details as that day draws near. If you have an Android device, if you have an iOS, iPhone device, or iPad, the app will be available for you in a week. It will cost you all of $0. $0. You will be able to listen to the show live. You will be able to watch the show live. You will be able to one press IM the show. One press call the show. If you are a freebie listener, you'll be able to hear the last 25 episodes at a touch of a button. If you are a member, once you log in on the phone, which is easy to do because Kyle is a genius, you will be able to access the last, I think, 200 to 300 shows. Just as easy as you could listen to yesterday's show. We are also working. We had a little report that the on 3G, the show is cutting out. We're working on creating a secondary stream for the app that would actually break it down a little bit so that you can listen to it on 3G. It's going to be fantastic. We want you all to download it at the same time so that I can at least take a picture of my computer if the app hits iTunes and says, you know, what's hot. That's basically why we want you to do it.
Maybe we get to the top of a very specific niche.
Yes, a very specific niche. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Duss. I should also say this music, apropos of our conversation, is a rendition of Blueberry Hill, the old Fats Domino song, sung by Vladimir Putin. We'll be right back.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill.
All right. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. I couldn't help myself, folks. That was Vladimir Putin's rendition of Blueberry Hill. On the phone, policy analyst from the Center for American Progress, Matt Duss. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot.
So I want to go through, obviously, well, let's start a little bit. Just give us a little bit. I mean, we've obviously talked about Syria on this program over the past couple of months or so, maybe a little more, but not terribly extensively. Just go back and sort of give us a sense of how we've got to the place where there are now 2 million Syrian refugees. Reports of up to 100,000 killed in this civil war. Correct me if I'm wrong in characterizing it that way. Just give us a sense of how this has progressed and how we got to where we are now.
Sure. No, I think it's quite correct to call it a civil war. That's clearly what's going on. The uprising in Syria started along with the whole, the whole bunch of other uprisings that started in early 2011, began, in late 2010 in Tunisia with a fruit vendor setting himself on fire that kicked off demonstrations against the Tunisian government, which soon spread to Egypt, the famous demonstrations in Tahrir Square, which resulted in Hosni Mubarak, the longtime president of Egypt, stepping down, demonstrations in Yemen, elsewhere in across the Arab world, and then to Syria. It began as with the other demonstrations and uprisings as a nonviolent movement. Pretty soon, the Syrian government, which has a record of brutality, began cracking down. I think this is about April 2011 when it really started seriously cracking down on the demonstrations, and it soon turned into a violent uprising, a violent insurgency against the government of Bashar al-Assad, and has continued since then. You've seen, there are elements of the anti-Assad insurgency that are secular, that are democratic. There are other elements that are much more inclined toward a jihadist al-Qaeda type outlook. The Jabhat al-Nusra, which is one of the most formidable factions in the anti-Assad insurgency, is closely linked with al-Qaeda in Iraq and the broader al-Qaeda movement. This is one of the issues here. It's like, okay, who are we supporting this insurgency against Assad, even knowing that if they take over, we could have another serious problem. But then there's the issue of just state collapse, which is something we saw in Iraq when the central authority just breaks down. it creates spillover effects that we can't control. And frankly, we're already seeing spillover effects. As you mentioned, 2 million refugees, many hundreds of thousands in neighboring Jordan, which is creating a considerable pressure on the Jordanian government, in Turkey, in Lebanon as well. So we're at a point now where there's a real question of what's worse, military action or not military action. And I think reasonable progressives, in my view, can come to different conclusions.
All right. Now, I want to go back to just briefly as we talk about what led to this civil war. It was an interesting, and I don't know if you've seen it, but I imagine you have, that William Polk, I guess in an email exchange with James Fallows, sort of laid out a lot of different issues regarding it. But one thing that he brought up, which I thought was sort of fascinating, William Polk was in the Kennedy administration, in the State Department, I believe, that he mentioned that Syria was subject to a prolonged drought in from 06, I believe it was, to 2011, which he attributes in no small part to global climate change, and that this was creating a tremendous amount of poverty. Crop failures reached 75%. 85% of livestock died. You had hundreds of thousands of Syrian farmers gave up and abandoned their farms, fled to the cities and towns. That UN experts at the time estimated between 2 and 3 million of Syria's 10 million rural inhabitants were reduced to extreme poverty. On some level, I mean, we saw economics play some role in the Egyptian upheaval. In fact, the man who set himself on fire in Algeria was doing this because he couldn't make a living.
Right.
That this, just briefly, just talk about that element of it, because, you know, so I just don't want to gloss over the fact that we've been hearing for quite some time that global climate change is going to create social upheaval. And this seems to me to be a perfect model of how this implicates us, even if, you know, we don't have people rioting in the Dust Bowl in this country.
Right. No, I think that's a very important point. You're absolutely right. The fruit vendor who lit himself on fire, yeah, did so out of frustration with the corruption and his inability to support himself and his family. The lack of jobs and the lack of political or economic development and an economic future was a huge driver, especially among the young people who powered the demonstrations in Egypt. And very clearly, one of the factors driving the uprising in Syria. I mean, I think as we know from looking at history, as it even says in the Declaration of Independence, human beings, you know, given the choice, if they're doing well economically, they're willing to put up with a certain amount of tyranny rather than taking the chance of fighting against a tyrannical ruler. But when you add economic deprivation and lack of an economic future to that, that's something that really tends to push people over the edge and into protesting government and even taking up arms. And I think that's what we've seen in Syria.
Okay, and now, before we sort of move forward from recent developments, just give us a sense of where, I mean, I think there is, you know, there's so many factions involved in the rebellion, and it plays into the larger regional dynamics of that breakdown across sectarian lines in many respects. So give us a sense. I mean, where is the Assad regime in that range of sectarian, I guess, fissures that exist in that region?
Yeah, I mean, that's really important to understand that this is in many ways a proxy conflict for a number of different combatants and parties. First, the Assad regime, his father Hafez al-Assad, who took power in the early 1970s, is from a very small religious sect known as the Alawites in Syria. They're basically regarded as a small sect of Shiite Islam. They've been allied with the Shiite government of Iran for several decades. They are seen by Iran as their key partner in the Arab world. The alliance with Syria allows Iran an entree into the Levant area. Syria is a key transfer point for weapons for Hezbollah in Lebanon. What we see is a competition, as we saw in Iraq, a sort of competition with Iran on one side and Saudi Arabia on the other, Saudi Arabia being one of the main supporters of the opposition against the Assad government. So you've got that sort of cold war, although not so cold in Syria, between Iran and Saudi Arabia. You've also got the aspect where, you know, you've got Russia as another main backer of Syria. They have a very a deep water port there in Tartus that they value a great deal. So they, as we've seen, they value that relationship with Assad, but it's also a point of leverage for them. They can kind of, you know, tweak the United States a little bit. So you've got an element of this, which is a growing competition between the United States and Russia. And then you have the broader, you've got the Al-Qaeda aspect to this. Al-Qaeda, which, as I described earlier, is a significant part, even though not a majority part, but a very, in terms of fighting skill, a very effective part of this anti-Syria insurgency. So, yeah, there are a bunch of sort of cross-cutting tensions and conflicts going on here.
Okay, and so that brings us up to, the recent chemical attack on the 21st. I mean, give me your sense, and there was reports of earlier chemical attacks as well, which seem to have been less conclusive as to who perpetrated them. But give me your sense on your sense of just how sure we are or are not that it was the Assad regime that perpetrated these chemical attacks.
Well, let's see. We haven't seen the actual evidence from UN inspectors yet, but we do have an assessment by the U.S. intelligence community that assesses with high confidence that these weapons were used by the Assad regime. I do think I think it's always good to be skeptical about intelligence, but I do think it's also worth noting that the intelligence community feels very, very acutely the hangover from Iraq and wants to be very, very certain here. I'm not saying that's a dispositive case for believing it. I'm just saying it's good to understand that they feel, as, you know, more than anyone, you know, that they have to get this right. I think we pretty soon. I would hope that the United States would, as part of, you know, generating legitimacy or support for action, would push for a hearing at the UN Security Council where the evidence can be put out there. But that's where we are right now.
Why has President Obama moved so why did he move so quickly as opposed to waiting for the UN weapons inspectors to come back with their report?
You know, I don't really have a good answer for that. I think waiting for the UN inspectors would have been a better move. I think perhaps he might have hoped by announcing action to create, you know, a greater sense of urgency from the UN inspectors. But, you know, he made the decision when he did, how he did. I'm really not sure why he did it.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be one of the strangest aspects of this, because, if we are so sure that it was the Assad regime, and from everything that I have read, to the extent that I, sitting here as a layperson who's only just reading what people like yourself is writing and others, it seems like that's the case. It really seems odd that they didn't wait for the UN to do this. I mean, and it's quite possible that's just a mistake in some respects. But so let's go forward here. So President Obama announces that he wants to essentially what is the argument for people who say, and I mean, I share your skepticism, and I don't think this is a good idea, but that we should attack Syria. But what is the argument for people who say that we need to do something because of the use of chemical weapons, which killed, depending on whose numbers you use, the high end, 1,500 people, 400 plus of whom were children. That's the high end, as opposed to having done nothing when 100,000 people had died within the conflict. I mean, what is the argument? What makes chemical weapons so specifically problematic?
Well, as I described in my piece in the American Prospect last week, there's basically two main arguments for it. The first is that, you know, the president in comments last year said explicitly that if chemical weapons were used, this would be a game changer, basically drawing a red line for the Assad regime, saying don't cross this line toward and use these weapons or there will be consequences. And that having drawn that red line, people, you know, the international community and dictators around the world need to understand that the United States means what it says, and that the credibility of the United States is on the line here, and therefore we need to take action because the president said we would. The second argument is that there is this international norm against the use of chemical weapons. It's a global progressive good. I agree with that. And in order to uphold this international norm, we need to show that there will be consequences when anyone uses these weapons. And as sort of a sub point there, it's also, you know, what can we do not only in punishing Assad for using the weapons, but in these strikes, can we, you know, diminish his ability to use them again?
Now, in your American Prospect piece, you address both those arguments, and at the risk of people not going and reading your piece, but we will link to it. Would you dismiss those? You address, let's say, you address both those arguments. I think take the one about credibility.
Right. I think the credibility argument is easier to criticize. I mean, I think it's there's a whole mountain of literature, political science literature, that addresses the whole, you know, the idea of reputation and credibility, and this idea, which, you know, despite there being little evidence for it, is constantly trotted out as a reason for action. The idea, if we don't do this, then our enemies will question our will and will behave, you know, behave badly in the future. But, you know, the actual evidence shows it's very, very difficult to predict with any certainty how adversaries or friends or allies will interpret actions or inactions. So this idea that, you know, if we don't punish Assad or if we don't, you know, enforce this red line that the president drew, then everyone around the world will say, oh, well, the United States doesn't mean what it says. I mean, there's just very little evidence historically that that's the case. As to the second point,
wait, let me address that too. Is that, you know, I think at one point in the hearings yesterday, in the and we have some clip from those hearings that I may want to play you. But at one point, Senator Menendez, went on a story about a bully when he was in New Jersey or something to that effect, and that whole notion, this credibility notion. It seems to me like, yeah, I think there's some value to that notion if you have an 8-year-old child.
Yes.
I mean, speaking from experience, if I tell my daughter, look, you know, if you do this again, you're not going to watch, you're going to lose TV privileges this weekend, and I don't take away the TV that weekend, then it's the wrong lesson. But my 8-year-old daughter, the forces that act upon what she does seem to me to be far less complicated than those that act upon a leader of a country with broad constituencies and broad cross currents that are affecting sort of how that leader responds to things. I mean, that's really
absolutely
the issue, right?
I mean, that is in some of the pieces I link to in my piece. There are, as you said, a whole range of factors, and a whole, you know, that the Assad government might look at in determining how the United States might behave in the future. And this goes for Iran as well. We heard Iran mentioned numerous times in the hearings yesterday in the Senate, saying that if we don't do this, Iran will think we're not serious about, you know, preventing them from obtaining a nuclear weapon. And I think it's patently obvious that Iranians are smart enough to understand that, you know, the way the U.S. views their possible nuclear weapon as different from, you know, serious use of chemical weapons.
All right, this is a good time. Let's play this clip. I want to play this exchange between Udall and Kerry on Syria. It's a minute and a half or so. We may stop it because I just want you to address some of these points as we go through, because there were some parts of what Kerry was saying yesterday in testimony in the lead up to it that, you know, this was Well, sort of like a Munich moment, implying that in some way, if we appease Assad, then we're gonna, apparently Assad is gonna invade Poland. I'm not exactly sure how the logic goes, but let's play this clip. Hopefully you'll be able to hear this here. Okay, we're gonna play it and then we'll stop it at different points.
We're being told we're bombing in order to send a message. But what message are we sending? To the international community, we're saying once again, the United States will be the world's policeman. You break a law, and the United States will step in. Americans are understandably weary. After the fiasco of Iraq and over a decade of war, how can this administration make a guarantee that our military actions will be limited?
This is not sending a message per se. This is having an effect, an impact. This is taking action to achieve something more than just a message. It is to degrade his current capacity.
By degrading him, you make
okay. Pause it for 1 second. Let's talk about that because I want to. This is the argument that that Kerry is sort of like he's having to sort of straddle a line here. The message ostensibly, right, would be you can't get away with chemical warfare without being punished. Now, and this you mentioned in your piece that that there's not necessarily great evidence that shows that if we don't do anything, we're going to see a rash of use of chemical weapons, right? Because we didn't do anything when Iraq did this in the early 90s, late 80s. And I can't think of another time since then, 20 some odd years ago, where there has been any other use of chemical weapons.
Right. And I think, you know, I think it's, you know, first, let's note that the United States, you know, would supported, if not just acquiesced, in Iraq's use of chemical weapons against Iran.
We've all seen that picture of Rumsfeld shaking hands with him, right? I mean,
that's right. But yeah, as I note, I mean, we did not see an outbreak of dictators using chemical weapons after that. Now, granted, the sample size is very small here, and Syria could be an outlier. But the basic point I try to make is while I recognize that the international norm against chemical weapons is a global progressive good and something that should be supported, I mean, given the whole range of costs and benefits here, it just doesn't, you know, considering especially the possible consequences compared to the possible benefit, it just doesn't come down in favor for me.
All right. I want to continue on with this clip because this is an interesting moment where, I'm not quite sure I understand exactly what's going on here. Now, Udall says, if you're not just sending a message and you're degrading, Assad's capacity to wage war, because we're not degrading his capacity to wage chemical warfare, right? Because we're not going to touch those stocks because of fears of what happens when you blow up chemical weapons. Udall seems to be saying, aren't we helping possible extremist elements, as you mentioned, you know, sort of Al-Qaeda affiliates in the opposition? And then Kerry says, either doesn't understand the question or sort of completely pretends he got a different question. Keep the audio playing.
This is not sending a message per se. This is having an effect, an impact. This is taking action to achieve something more than just a message. It is to degrade his current capacity.
By degrading him, you make these extremist forces stronger, do you not?
No, I don't believe you do. As a matter of fact, I think you actually make the opposition stronger, and the opposition is getting stronger by the day now. You said, how do we know it won't result in X or Y or Z happening if we don't do it? Let me ask you. It's not a question of what will happen if we don't do it. It's a certainty. Are you going to be comfortable if Assad, as a result of the United States not doing anything, then gasses his people yet again, and the world says, why didn't the United States act?
I don't believe that we should have given up so easily on using the United Nations.
We haven't given
using
up.
Us. Yes, we have. We haven't taken Russia to task. We haven't taken China to task. And that's what we should be pointing out at this point.
Time.
All right. So let me just ask you this. What under what authority? I mean, John Kerry's saying that the rest of the world is going to be upset if we don't do anything at this point. And it's quite clear that the rest of the world is not necessarily gung-ho for this. What authority does the United States invoke to police the chemical warfare treaties?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, traditionally, the way you do this is you get a UN Security Council resolution that authorizes the use of force. I mean, states are permitted to defend themselves, but there's obviously no case here that the United States is under attack. As an international legal matter, there is no authority here. And I think that's very problematic. Now, recognizing that Russia and China, but mainly Russia, is blocking action on the UN Security Council, I think there is a fair argument to make that, you know, the U.S. needs to try and turn to other sources of legitimacy for its action, as we saw NATO being used in Kosovo, when Russia played a similar, blocking role, on the Security Council. But without NATO, without even our strongest and most important ally, Great Britain, supporting us, you know, there is a very real question here of how legitimate is this action. I think this is actually something that played a deciding factor in President Obama's decision to go to Congress to try to generate some domestic legitimacy for what he's doing, to try and then parlay it into greater international support, which we don't really have right now.
I mean, that to me seems to be the nub. I mean, I don't know that we have a perfect way to say, in situations where there is a perception of an imminent slaughter of civilians. We don't have a perfect way to make that determination. That's really what the function of the UN should be. And it
right.
seems to me that, you know, you could maybe there's a plausible argument that under because NATO is involved in the chemical warfare treaty of I think is in 93 that there's an argument there that maybe Turkey's interest or I don't know, but we don't seem to have any grounds upon which to function in this way other than some sort of a broader sense of like we've got to do this. Now, with that said, let's talk about President Obama going to Congress. There were two pieces out today, one by Ezra Klein and one by Brian Beutler, who said, the implication of both the pieces was that the openness of the administration, both in terms of Kerry saying at the beginning of the hearing that, look, it's possible we have to put boots on the ground, but we don't want to do that. And the Obama administration writing such a broad authorization for military force, in a way, put sort of forced Congress in some way to be a restraint on the Obama administration that the Obama
right.
administration couldn't be on its own. Does that make sense?
Right.
I mean, tease that out for us and explain how that works.
Well, I honestly, you cut out a little bit there.
Oh,
can you
sorry.
Just restate
okay.
the question?
Okay, yeah. So Brian Beutler and Ezra Klein had pieces today that sort of suggested that the administration being so open about the potential for boots on the ground and coming in with such a broad authorization for military force was a way of inviting Congress to sort of restrain the administration.
Okay, yeah. I thought that a little bit too, but I think that doesn't make sense to me just because a congressional no vote would be so damaging. I think those are both smart guys. I like them. I know them. I think they're great reporters. But that just seems to be kind of overthinking it to me. I think the way that this would be seen both domestically and internationally would be as a huge blow to the Obama administration. So I have real trouble thinking that that's how they're going about this.
In other words, there's no 11-dimensional chess going on here. It's just the way that's working out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, but I don't agree with it.
All right, now let me ask you this. It was reported today that, I believe it was today, that Russia, in the Jerusalem Post, that Russia has suspended the delivery of S-300 missile systems to Syria, apparently because Syria hasn't passed the 30-day window they have to pay their bills or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That literally they haven't paid. So we're delaying it by 1 to 2 years. In that same piece, Putin had said that Russia may approve a military operation in Syria if evidence shows that Damascus carried out the chemical weapons attack. Should we perceive this as an opening? In other words, as the United States gets closer, in the event that Congress does authorize something, does that raise the stakes for the Russians? Because if they think that they're going to lose their customer, essentially, in Assad, does it put them in a position of wanting to negotiate? And are they starting to set up some way for them to save face?
Yeah, you know, actually, I think that could be one of the better outcomes here, even possibly short of going through with the strikes. If you could, you know, if Congress okays this, then the president moves forward, and Russia, fearing exactly what you said, could be, you know, cajoled, inclined toward, you know, pushing, you know, with, you know, pulling back from supporting the Assad regime so much, or at least pushing elements of the regime to the table, which still remains the administration's policy, to get the parties to a negotiation in which Assad is taken out of power, but the institutions of the state are maintained at some level, so we don't have the complete collapse of the Syrian state. So, I mean, I think if the threat of these strikes could get Russia to behave more productively, I think that would be a good outcome.
Is there any way that the United States, I mean, is there any settlement that you see possible where Assad stays in power? In other words, does he have to leave?
I don't see any outcome in which Assad himself stays in power. I just don't. I mean, I think the question is, you know, what echelon, the second, third, fourth echelon of the Baathist government. You know, we have the experience in Iraq where you debathification, where you took out essentially all the people connected with Saddam's party, but that was essentially taking out all the people who knew how to run the state. We don't want to see that happen in Syria, but the question is how far down, you know, the line, do you want to clear out the people connected with this regime over the years?
Do guys like you and gals like you who study this stuff, do you have a notion of who those potential, you know, who is in this Assad regime that maybe the Russians are talking to, saying like, you know, this could be a good opportunity for you to get a promotion, that type of thing?
You know, I really don't. There was a there are others who study this much more closely than me who could probably give you a better answer. I know there was a Syrian general who just defected today. So, you know, that's a sign, you know, but this is an ongoing thing.
Right.
So I mean, that's the kind of thing we'd like to see, is, you know, greater defections, higher up defections from you know, which is a sign both internally and to the opposition that the regime is starting to fall apart.
And I presume it puts pressure on Russia too, that if they want to maintain a customer there, they have to get in and be more proactive.
All right.
So lastly, I just want to touch on this part too, because this has come up sort of peripherally, like in terms of Iran, there is some talk that the president needs to get or one argument that the president is supposedly offering to guys like John McCain, who apparently again today, I guess his iPhone, he may have lost in poker, and that has now sort of changed his disposition about supporting the president here, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it was some other game he was playing. That the administration was making an argument like, if you don't give us authority here, that's going to prevent us from maybe launching an attack on Iran, and we all know how much you guys want that. Can you just sort of explain to us those dynamics?
Yeah, it's a little bit confusing. I mean, first you have the credibility argument, as I was describing earlier. I mean, the idea that the United States needs to do this to make clear to a range of actors, including and perhaps most significantly the Iranian regime, that we, when we draw a red line, as the president did around a nuclear weapon, that we mean it, and there will be consequences if that line is crossed. But also, you know, there's an issue here with regarding presidential authority to carry out military action. So, you know, the administration basically seems to be arguing, you know, specifically toward people like McCain and even more so Senator Lindsey Graham, who has actually been very, very frank about his intention to lay down the tracks for an eventual attack on Iran, that, you know, if you kind of handicap us here by not supporting us, then it could be a problem later in trying to get international support, you know, for possible strikes on Iran, or at least signal that to Iran, which could undermine our negotiations with them.
Yeah, those guys are really concerned that they may not get that Iranian war. That would be extremely, I think, sad. missed opportunity for them. All right, well, you know, I appreciate your coming. So give me a sense. I mean, do you have a sense of how this is, what's going to happen in Congress? I mean, is the president going to get the authority? And what, when he goes to Russia, I think in the next day or two, right, for the G20 summit, I would assume that he would want that congressional, that resolved, right? Because he's sitting down with these other countries, particularly Russia, and they may discuss this. And if Congress is undecided, there's no way for any of these other countries to react.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I think, you know, it seems pretty clear he'll get the support of the Senate. The House is, you know, it's really up in the air right now. I mean, I think you've got more dedicated no votes at this point. But I'm really not sure. I mean, you've seen the administration obviously going full court press. You've got groups like AIPAC that have been, you know, brought in to lobby in favor. But at the same time, when you see even Liz Cheney running for Congress or running for the Senate in Wyoming, who's opposing this. I mean, let me repeat that. Liz Cheney opposes this military intervention, which says something about the mood out there among voters. I really don't know.
Well, Matt Duss, thanks so much for your time today. It's been very enlightening, and really appreciate your keeping us up to date on this.
Sure, happy to.
All right, folks, that is that marks the time in which we head into the better half of the program, wherein we have audio of we'll get some good Pat Robertson audio. I also want to say something about yesterday. I held a libertarian on the line for too long, I guess.
Way too long.
I know. I think I was a little rusty. I've been on vacation. I had been. We spoke to this guy for a long time who had trouble distinguishing between markets and society. And so for that, I apologize. I hope in some way it was enlightening. But I don't want to discourage any libertarians for calling in. Hopefully, we have put out a challenge to have libertarians who are a little bit more on their game call in and discuss. I will also be mindful of the clock. Also, in the better half of the program, we'll be discussing, like I said earlier, Fukushima and the NYPD designation of mosques in New York as terrorist organizations so they could basically run amok. Just a bit of house cleaning. Tomorrow is the Jewish New Year. It's one of the best-kept secrets on this show that I am Jewish, and I'll be celebrating Rosh Hashanah. So are you guys gonna fill in or what? Are we gonna play a repeat?
We're gonna fill in, right, Michael?
Filling in.
All right, these guys are only like just between the two of you, like one quarter Jewish or something like that, or what is it? I don't know. They won't, they're allowed, they've got special dispensation, I guess, from like a one-quarter rabbi to do the show tomorrow. I'll be back Friday with Cliff Schechter and a yet-to-be-named movie host. And then that's it, folks. Then I'm here all the time. You don't have to worry. There's no more No more Jewish holidays. No more vacation. No more paternity leave. That's it.
Ever?
There ain't going to be any more paternity leave. I can assure you that right now. All right, folks. See you in the better half. 646-257-3920. If you're listening on the app, I am me. First one, I guess we don't really have any prizes. But first one to I am from the app.
We'll go down in history as the first person to I am from the app.
Yeah, we'll put that on the maybe on the how-to app page on the blog. 646-257-3920. You can I am me from your computers. If you are not an app beta tester, see you in the better half.
Say to the bouquet.